Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week we take a break from pandemics and property and instead turn our attention to the rising problem of finding sustainable and worthwhile income in the current low interest rate environment. As central banks worldwide have eased rates in response to the coronavirus and to help minimise financial interest pressure during and to support growth on the other side of the pandemic, common low-risk income options available to retirees and pensioners have been reduced to fractions of their usual rates of return. This presents a tough job for both self-funded retirees and institutions who provide the pension products, as the need to reach for riskier assets rises or be faced with potentially running out of capital. Here to help us find income in a zero interest rate environment, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And just a quick reminder, but before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and to click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live now, feel free to drop in your questions along the way in the chat box at nucleuswealth.com/webinar. So let's get into it. So the agenda for today, we're going to start with a rounded philosophical outlook on approach to yield. We'll then be looking at a range of different bonds. So firstly, government bonds, and then turning our view to corporate bonds. We'll then be looking at stocks and looking at another form of, I guess, dividend income as opposed to bond income. And then finally, rounding it out, as we always do, with an investment outlook and how we use these themes in the portfolios at Nucleus Wealth. So to get us started, we'll jump into something slightly philosophical, Damien, our approach to yield.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I guess the main thing I wanted to sort of drive through this, and it's I might be giving it all up front. We might lose a few watches after this. Is that we need to acknowledge that things have changed, and that we are in this low interest rate world, and that what's worked in the past isn't going to work now. Mm. It's a part of going, well, you know, I live with a house full of teenagers, and they can eat pretty much whatever they want and don't add a lot of weight and all that type of stuff. And I used to be able to do that, but as you get older, all of a sudden you can't do the same things, and that's effectively, you know, a similar type of message now is that being able to say that I've got a block of money and I'm just going to live off the interest and not eat into the capital. Is basically not an option anymore. You know, I think there's the choice of actually saying you're going to get out there and refuse to accept, you know, these low dividends and get out and chase higher dividend stocks and riskier scenarios to try and replace that income. The danger that is there is you're just going to lose your capital. And so if you're running a risk of losing capital, I guess what I'm saying is you're better off saying, well, I'll purposely take a small amount of my capital off every year with the view that to get what you need to survive, rather than chasing this higher dividend yield and ending up losing the capital anyway on the other side because it's a much higher risk where you'd have to stray to get those types of returns. So that's the first point. The other point, the key point though, is that inflation is, and it's very hard to, it's very hard for people to get over this, the view that inflation is something that's there and it is eating into your income every year. So if I'm sitting there with, you know, say a $500,000, retirement, nest egg, and you're sitting there sort of chipping away at that every year, if there's 3 or 4% inflation out there, and then you're adding on another 2 or 3%, to get this nice high yield, and you feel as if you're sitting there not eating into your capital, so your 500 is not staying, it's just staying where it is, and you're generating this 7% yield and using that to fund your lifestyle, that might feel like you're not eating into your capital. But if inflation is, as I said at the start, sort of 3 or 4%, then you are actually eating into your capital from a real perspective. It's just it doesn't feel like you're doing that. And I guess where we are now is we're in this world of low inflation and low interest rates, and so the that same part, I guess you're not from a real perspective. You might end up in the same position.
Hmm.
In that you're still going backwards slightly every year in a real sense. But it's what's going to hurt is that now it's actually in a nominal sense as well, and people like to see that their balance, you know, isn't changing. And I guess there's so I guess you've got two choices. One is you either up your risk and run the risk that you lose capital, and we'd suggest that for most people who income is an important factor, that shouldn't be your option, because if almost by definition, if you want this stability, then you shouldn't be chasing those types of ones. Or the second part is then, so there's a bunch of things we can do to try and ameliorate that and try and actually find some income that's going to help you. And we'll go into that in the rest of the podcast.
Mm.
But understanding that the world has changed and accepting it and not trying to chase, not seeing, you know, who was the Mayfair one that came out recently, you know.
Was it 6 to 8% or something?
That's right.
First mortgages I think that's, you know, and that's a big thing. Obviously, you know, we've got term deposits now that's sort of in the 1 to 1.5% mark. And as you say, you know, the first thing people think about is, oh, well, I'm going backwards, you know, just against inflation, which is normally, you know, the 1.5 to 2.5 sort of range. I guess in a way it's a psychological change that needs to happen as much as an investment change, perhaps.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think there's that the part where you see these things like the, you know, that like the Mayfair, where they are advertising, you know, 6 to 8%. In this environment, you need to look very, very suspiciously at any of that.
Bit of a red flag.
Exactly. It's interesting. We run it in our models on stocks as well. But it's a very common phenomenon, is that amongst all investment professionals, in that you know, you see a yield of 1%, and you go, okay, that's pretty low. And then, let's say we're looking at stocks, and then you see a yield of like 4 or 5%, and you're like, okay, that's a pretty decent yield. You can get out of that stock, and whatever you get. And then you see a yield of like 8 or 9%, and you're like, oh, what's wrong here? You're like, that's not. It's too high to be real. There's a problem there, and and that's sort of getting back to this one of these I've got there, the yield or value traps, and what these ones are is these are the ones where it's in there at it's got a the stocks at a dollar, and stocks at $10 and it's paying a dollar dividend, so you're getting like this 10% yield. It looks fantastic. But 6 months later, the stock, the management suddenly says, we're not going to pay a dollar in dividends anymore. We're only going to pay 50 cents.
Mm.
And so the share price halves.
Halves, yeah.
And so you're still getting a 10% yield on it. It's just that, you know, you started with a $10 investment, and now
you've lost 50% on the capital.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well. And it's still on this, and still the yield still looks fantastic, because people are looking at these things and saying the yields aren't sustainable.
Mm.
So that's one part. The next part is the tax effectiveness as well. So it is worth, this is this philosophical approach as well, in terms of looking at it saying, well, if you could have a choice of getting a 5% return as a capital gain, or a 5% return as an income, depending upon your tax situation, for a lot of people, the capital gain is actually more attractive from a tax perspective.
Because of the discount, because the 12-month 50% discount.
Yep. You get the 12-month, that's right. And also it gives you the chance to, you can manage, especially if you've got a portfolio of shares, you can manage it a bit better.
Yep.
So for example, we run separately managed accounts for our clients, where we have the same portfolio, but every client gets sort of their own shares within it. And what we did just before the end of financial year is we're sitting on some decent capital gains over the year, and then we had a dig through the stocks and just went, look, where are the stocks where we're actually happy to own a different stock and we're sitting on a loss from it. And so it's a matter of then saying, okay, well, let's take the loss on that.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps to offset the quite significant gains we'd made sort of elsewhere in the portfolio. It means that the tax situation, from a tax perspective, it's much more efficient for the users. So
sure.
So I guess what I'm saying is, don't get too hung up on the whole part about I have to get this yield from these stocks. If you can get the same result, in a more tax effective measure by getting in this capital gains and then selling some stock, you might find you're actually in a better position after tax.
Yep.
The other thing with the tax effectiveness as well is, you know, this is, I guess, a lesson from my younger days when I first started investing is, you know, I found there was this structure that structured product had been set up so that it delivered distributions as capital returns, and it was very, looked like it was going to be really tax effective in terms of the way it was, and then you got the capital gains and everything later on. So it seemed like it was going to be really, really tax effective, and it actually ended up being way more tax effective than I thought, mainly because it was a lot higher risk than I'd realized, and rather than having to worry about paying tax on dividends, I didn't have to worry about the dividends at all, and I had a capital loss to make it even more tax effective for me. So I guess that's the first thing, you know, is you should always be investing on the basis of the actual investment first.
Hmm.
So dig through the investment. What am I doing? What return am I getting on this investment? And then once you're done, now you can look at the tax structuring and how it's going to be most effective.
Yep.
Because there's a bunch of things out there that'll go, you know, you take a fair bit of risk and you might get, say, a 3 or 4% return on it, and it might be, you know, very tax effective, that 3 or 4% return, which might, you know, let's say it's fully franked or something and turns it into 6 or 7. But if you just take a step back and looked at it, you know, without assuming the tax part,
that's right. Well,
is it worth getting a 3 or 4% return for taking this much risk?
Yep.
And if the answer is no, then you shouldn't be doing it just to try and chase the tax stuff. So I guess,
Well, that's right. I've seen it time and time again in my time as well, where the tax benefits is what it leads on. There's a range of all things out there, you know, from agroforestry to ostrich farms to you name it, you know, and it's sort of, you know, you get a big tax lead-in deduction at the front, and then people will invest, you know, and I think Australians are quite driven to mitigate and minimize and get tax efficiencies where they can. Probably say that to investment properties as well. So at the end of the day, as you say, though, you've got to make sure that the underpinnings of the investment are, you know, what you're actually investing in is the piece that you're concentrating on. And if you get the tax benefit, that's the bonus at the background.
Yeah. As soon as you pick up a prospectus or a PDS or whatever for some sort of capital and you notice that they spend more time talking about the tax effectiveness than what they do actually about the underlying investment.
Yep.
Yeah, that's you should be red lights flashing and sirens and, you know,
that's right,
backing out quietly.
Mm.
So, yeah. So I guess what I'm saying philosophically, don't get hung up on the fact that there's no way I can eat into my capital, because chances were in prior years you were actually eating into your capital anyway.
Mm.
You just didn't notice it because it was coming from more from interest rates, more from inflation, sorry, than it was from in actual normal terms. So that sort of leads on to the next part is philosophically, you need to also be looking at sustainability of dividends is very important. There's a lot of stocks out there where you look at them and they're probably the dividends are sustainable in the short term. Maybe some tobacco stocks are ones that might sort of fit that criteria where you can see short-term sustainability of dividends, but over the longer term, they're definitely not sustainable. And so, as you're looking through what you're looking to buy or whatever it needs to be, you need to be keeping that factor in mind. And then the part is growth of dividends. So, what we're trying to do as we're putting together income portfolios for investors is we're trying to find the right mix of the two, where you're saying, okay, I can get a higher yield by buying this stock now, and I can see where the dividends are going to start to fade off over time. But if I can flip that out with some other stocks which have a lower yield right now, but I can see where they're growing and the yield's going to increase in over time, then the net effect of buying a portfolio of those might be that I get quite a steady yield at a higher level than what I would if I just bought all the growth ones, or if I just tried to chase the, if you go for just the the highest yield ones, quite often what you'll find is that that portfolio you yield will decrease over time because they're priced, they're priced for the yields falling. So you get that higher upfront and lower going forward. So there's that part. And the other part is that what's important to notice that a lot of people don't focus. The other real effect of having low interest rates is that capital becomes a lot more volatile. So, and the reason why I say that is, if let's say we're talking about bonds, if you're looking at a bond that's got a 6 or 7% yield, and that bond moves by 0.5%, that doesn't make much difference at all to the overall capital that's in there. Whereas when interest rates are 0.5%. And they go to 0 or they go to 1%, that makes a big difference to the
huge
capital.
Difference.
Yeah. So the capital's a lot more volatile. And the same is true for stocks when they're on higher PEs, as we're seeing at the moment, is that priced on a very expensive basis, what it means, though, is that you do get a lot more volatility because when you're pricing something, say, on a common measure is what's called a price to earnings ratio. So how much the stock is worth versus how much it's earning. So typically that's sort of like 15 times or below. At the moment, it's more like 20 times. Mm. And so what that means is a small miss on the earnings front is now magnified by 20 times or 25 times versus, 10 or 15 times. So it's sort of, you can see double the effect of the volatility on the share price. By changes in either yields or in the earnings that these companies have. So I guess as you're putting together a yield portfolio in a low interest rate environment, you also need to factor in that you're going to need more diversification than what you might have needed in the past.
Okay.
So yeah, in the past you could get away with a few instruments and because they're more stable, whereas now it's I want to spread them out. Mix of sustainability and growth to try and make sure that over time I'm not going to lose out. And the last one I wanted to highlight was just some charts on dividends and buybacks. So in Australia, it's worth noting that you get this much higher yield in Australia because companies pay out more in dividends. And the reason why they pay out more in dividends is because Australia is relatively unique in having franking credits, which pass back to investors.
Mm.
And so if you look at the Australian payout ratios, you sort of see that Australian payouts are sort of 60, 70, 80% versus the world, which is more like 30 or 40%. The only thing is, though, that's because a lot of the rest of the world, the companies return their money through buybacks. And then you can see if you add that in on the chart on the right, you actually end up back where some years Australia is lower, some years it's higher, but it's much more similar in terms of once you add in buybacks. And so what a buyback effectively does is a company has a parcel of money they need to give back, that they want to give back. So let's say the company's worth $1 billion and they're going to give back $50 million, so 5% of the company. If they can either pay that out as a dividend, and what will happen is the share price will drop by 5%. You'll get the cash in your hand. Share price drops by 5%. And so the effect, what you had before and what you had after is the same. And then they'll build up to the next one. Whereas with a buyback, what happens is the cash still goes out to some shareholders and it reduces the number of shareholders. But what typically happens is the share price will increase by 5% because you've actually got rid of 5% of your shareholders.
Mm. So it's tightening the register, so to speak.
Yeah, and basically everyone gets a bit of a bigger slice of the pie.
Mm.
So the pie still stays a similar size, but everyone gets a bigger slice. And so the issue is, from that perspective, is the net outcome is pretty similar. You either got 5% as income or 5% as capital gain. Obviously, the income's cash in your hand, and it feels a lot safer and all that type of stuff. But over a longer period of time, and whereas the share price can be volatile, but over a longer period of time, the two will even themselves out at similar multiples. So it's that same point about saying, if you're looking at companies that are, and the way we look at companies is companies that are returning capital to shareholders is a good thing, as opposed to companies that just keep having to suck in more capital to fund, you know, the growth ambitions.
Mm.
And so, so it's a good sign that, that companies can actually afford, they're actually generating enough cash flow to give some back to shareholders. And we don't get too hung up about whether it comes back as a dividend or whether it comes back as a buyback. I think what you'll find in Australia is because of the franking credits, when companies can't afford to pay a dividend, what they'll actually do is they'll still pay the dividend, but they'll then actually raise capital to effectively the amount of capital that they need to pay the dividend.
Right.
So a dividend reinvestment plan, that's effectively what all that is, is saying we can't afford to pay this dividend, so we're going to raise some capital to in order to pay it. And so it's again, it's just another one to keep in mind in terms of that whole structuring argument is, you know, it doesn't matter whether you make a capital gain from them doing a buyback and then you sell some of the shares, or does it 5% of shares, or does it matter whether you you get a dividend? And for different people with different tax scenarios, you know, it's a different outcome.
Mm.
But largely, it's a pretty similar outcome. And if you manage it right, it can be better if you're doing the selling down part from a tax perspective.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, because you've got if you've got the ability to use those capital gains discounts and,
yes,
and that sort of thing, then yeah, puts you ahead of them.
Yeah, and if you're running a reasonably sized portfolio that you can different stocks you can buy or sell.
Yep.
And actually the other thing as well is even if you've just been a long term investor and you've been dripping money in over time, you can use the ability that you go, well, you know, here's a time when I happen to buy a stock at a higher share price, and so I can sell that parcel with a lower capital gain than the ones I bought 20 years ago that I'm sitting on some massive capital gain for.
Yeah, true. Yep.
Yeah, so there's lots of little tips and tricks you can do in terms of those. So, so that's sort of the overall philosophical side about it. It's saying you need to change your mindset and don't get hung up on my capital cannot go backwards. I absolutely have to make sure that I'm getting a high enough yield to fund everything.
Mm.
You need to switch that mentality, and then the next part is that whole philosophical sustainability and growth versus. And acknowledging much more diversification than what you had in the past because of the volatility you're going to get in capital prices. So sure. That sort of leads across into how you can do that with government bonds. So the issue with government bonds, and it's been described as picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, in that there's this big potential downside to government bonds. And in that if interest rates rise quickly, then you can lose a lot of money on that side of it.
On present bonds. Yeah.
Let me take a step back actually. Let me talk about a 10-year government bond. Because I think it's probably better if I, put it in perspective. So a 10-year government bond is actually, a very secure investment in a government if you're investing in your own local government, especially if you've got one like Australia that's got its own printing press, or the US or the UK where they can print their own money, is the chance of them defaulting is very, very low because they can just print.
Mm.
It'll basically be a political decision at some stage. And almost always in the past when that happens, the first people what governments will usually do is they'll pay out local bondholders and they'll default on foreign bondholders because foreigners don't vote and locals do. And then, it's only in really, really extreme circumstances that they default on local borrowers. It's much more likely that they just run the printing presses and inflate their way out of it. Okay, so when I say they're one of the most secure out there is because I know when I buy a bond on day one what I'm going to get over that entire period. So if I'm holding this thing to maturity, there's no surprises, there's no guesses. It's not like I have to worry about what interest rates are doing or anything like that, because I know, for example, if I bought a 10-year bond today, I might get say a 3% or 4% dividend yield on that, and I might have to pay more for it because I might have to pay $110, and in 10 years' time I'll sell it for $100, and I'll get like a 3 or 4% yield over time, and that capital value will gradually go down from 110 back down to 100.
Mm-hmm.
And that's locked in. There's no, it's not what you know, what will I get at the end, or will my dividend payment, if they raise interest rates or lower interest rates, will my yield change? It doesn't change. That's locked in from day one. So it's basically as predictable as you can get in terms of an investment. So the issue is, though, if interest rates rise, then that will change. So because that 3 or 4% is locked in, if interest rates suddenly overnight rose to 6%, what would happen is that bond would fall from $110 back to about $80.
Mm.
And then the $80 would gradually increase over time back to the 100 at the end. So as an investor, if you'd bought it at 110 and you were holding it to maturity, yes, it's fallen to $80, but if you're holding it to maturity, X having to sell it for emergency reasons, you actually don't care. Your cash flows haven't changed. All that's happened is the opportunity set out there has changed.
Mm-hmm.
So the big issue is, though, with these is the speed of adjustment is the key part. Is that, so, you know, if you're investing in 10-year bonds and, you don't, usually people don't have like just one bond. Like most people have what they call a bond ladder, and that's effectively what we do for our most of our core bond investments is mm-hmm. you have basically a bond expiring every year for the next, whatever it is, 12 or 15 years. And so you might have 15 bonds, one expiring every year, and every year one will expire, and you basically just take the money from that one and stick it back on the end out in 15 years' time, and just they all shuffle down. And so if the 10-year bond yield moved to, say, 6% over 10 years, then you wouldn't actually lose money on your bond. You'd actually make a profit, because what would be happening is, because it's a gradual move, every year you're taking one off and adding it back onto the end. It's not going to be a big profit. Like you're only going to make about 0.5% per annum.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like you're losing. It's not like your overnight move where you might lose 35% overnight if interest rates move to 6% overnight. And if it was faster, if interest rates moved to 6% over 5 years, you'd still make a loss. But it's going to be like about a 2 or 3% loss per annum. Like it's not a big change. So it's not a good outcome, obviously.
Yep.
But it's not a dramatically poor outcome. And the issue with so some people describe this, because interest rates are so low, as picking up pennies in front of steamrollers, in that you're getting these low returns from buying government bonds, but your risk is you get run over by the steamroller.
Yep.
And there's some truth to that. But the issue at the moment is the steamrollers, you can hear it's in reverse. So it's got the sound's beeping.
Yep.
So you're picking up pennies in front of it, yes, but it's going the other direction.
Yeah,
and so
sure.
When the beeping stops and it starts coming back in the other direction, that's you do need to make sure you're not trying to push this too far in terms of bonds. But that real issue in terms of the risks in bonds is inflation.
Hmm.
So getting that and if inflation comes back suddenly, and all this money printing that government's been doing, when that finally gets traction, there'll be time to jump out of these. But at the moment, we're sort of looking at it going, we don't have lots of bonds, but we've certainly got a bit in there. We've got the view that Australia's got some of the highest returns on bonds in the world, and most other countries are basically at zero or below. And so, if Australia goes more similar to other countries, there's sort of a 5 to 10% upside, and if you got things really wrong, you might be losing 2% per annum. And so with a 5 or 10% upside and you're getting a yield and you've locked in some returns, it's sort of saying, well, that's as part of a diversified portfolio, it's worth having.
Mm.
But that interest rates, inflation is a key thing to be watching.
So and just on that, you mentioned before, so with global or other, international bonds. Just some thoughts on why they're not in our portfolio, or why you wouldn't use those in preference to the Aussie bonds, Damien?
Yeah, so the issue when you buy, say, a US bond is US government bond is you're taking two different risks. You're taking one risk is the solvency risk, and as I said before, if something goes wrong, and it's a low chance in the US, obviously, but if something goes wrong, countries will default on foreign investors first. So you can effectively pick up the same return on Aussie bonds as what you can in. That's one risk. The second one is the currency risk. You're not getting paid high returns at the moment, and you're taking currency risk on the bonds, and so you're really making more of a currency bet than an investment bet. The issue you need to consider then is you say, well, you can what's called swap that out, so you can lock your returns in so that you do get your returns locked in at Aussie dollars.
Yep.
But once you do that, and after you've paid for it all, you actually end up with basically the return on the Australian bonds anyway.
Right. Yep.
So what we're basically saying is, for the sake of the for some traders, it's worth doing because there's small amounts of arbitrage you can get, but they're doing big trades with lots of leverage and long short positions. Whereas for most investors, the hassle of actually buying an international bond, then swapping out the currency just to bring it back into Aussie means you've effectively got the same yield as what you would have got by buying the Australian one, and you're running greater risk. Not a huge risk, for most countries, but there still is a risk of a much higher risk of default.
All right. Yeah, look, thanks for that. We just had a quick question here as well, just on that inflation piece. So from listener Ben, besides runaway inflation, what would lift interest rates, do you think? What are some other risks to rising interest rates for the average federal bondholder?
That's about it, really, at the moment. there's default risk, I suppose.
Yep.
That's the major one. But at the moment, central banks are all focused very much on trying to get inflation. That's why they're pumping so much money into the economy. And so until we really see that start to take, and keep in mind, the Japanese government, so Japanese central bank's been at it for 20 something years now, trying to do the same thing. Certainly the US looks to be doing more than what Japan did, but it is worth noting that it's certainly not a given that that inflation's coming in the short term.
And it sort of leads into an interesting one, I guess. So, we've got Japan, who have had a very long history of basically trying to win, to drive inflation and central banks. I think, what is it now, after 120% or something of GDP or something's on the balance sheet of the Bank of Japan. Is that right? Something in that vein?
Yeah. And basically what you do is there's more of the debt is with the Bank of Japan than what's not with the Bank of Japan.
Well, yep. and then obviously the US has had, let's call it nearly 10 years now post GFC of stimulating to drive inflation. It doesn't seem to be doing much as well. Got Australia now recently, beginning open market operations during the corona, pandemic and turbulence in March with what they were doing to support bond prices. Is there a view here that maybe it's just not going to work? is inflation risk actually a risk given what's been happening with the central banks? Obviously in a developed country over an emerging country, perhaps there's probably some easy examples on that side. But
yeah, I think there's there's a longer philosophical question we could have. We probably spent a whole podcast on that one, and I suspect we probably have in the past, but. There's this issue about inequality is probably one of the biggest ones, just in terms of people who are rich save money and people who are poor spend it. And so and because we're increasing inequality at the moment, and most of these policies around printing more money and propping up asset markets just goes to further increase inequality. And that means that's more reason not to have inflation. So inflation really, there's two parts to it. One's just demand driven inflation, and the other one's supply driven inflation. So on the demand side, there's the issue is how many people have lost jobs around the world, and are now unemployed and so can't afford to pay, and also the people who are no longer out, well, they're in lockdowns or they're limited in terms of just the whole psyche in terms of confidence and needing to they might have lost their own job, but they might have seen a lot of friends lose it and so feel the need to build up some more savings. So so from the demand side, there doesn't look to be a lot of demand at the moment in most areas. And then it's sort of similar in the supply areas, in that supply is similar in that a lot of companies have a lot of excess slack. Mm. And so when companies have a lot of excess slack, they just want to get rid of it. And so they'll sell it. You don't get inflation because you generally get inflation when there's too much money chasing too few goods. And so yep. those goods, the price gets bid up.
Yep.
So X a few things like sort of toilet paper or gym equipment or things like that. Home equipment. You know, there's not a lot of sort of excess demand out there. There's not a lot of shortage of supply.
Yep.
So maybe there will emerge shortage of supply if we come out quickly out of this. So that's one potential for it, I suppose. If or if so many people are, you know, maybe you'll get some inflation from if lots of people aren't working that are in sort of all the service industries, but all those people still obviously need to eat and buy stuff that's and that area doesn't expand.
Yep.
So yeah, possibly some things of that.
But it's pretty minor, really, in the grand scheme of things in the current.
Yeah,
climate.
At the moment, I guess what it is we've sort of shifted the burden of proof on inflation to saying, well, we want to see it first before we believe it's there, because there's been so much of it. You know, there's a bunch of economists, post the financial crisis, wrote to Ben Bernanke and high profile economists, wrote this open letter to Ben Bernanke saying, his policies were ruinous and there'd be hyperinflation and Weimar Germany was next and it was Zimbabwe. And they were completely wrong. Yep. Like he did exactly what he said he was going to do. And no inflation appeared. And so, we've got our reasons for believing why that is, but I guess the big investment part for me is until we actually really see that start to take track, we're not
bonds are usable.
It's an issue. Yeah, yep,
sure.
The other thing then with these is you can the 10-year bonds is when you see people quote returns on 10-year bonds, just keep in mind that's actually a trading strategy, not an investment. And what I mean by that is that 10-year bonds is actually basically saying, I buy a 10-year bond, and then in 6 months' time, I actually own a 9.5-year bond.
Mm.
So then I go and sell that bond, and then I go buy another. Well, you know, in 3 months' time, I've now got a 9.75-year bond, and then I go buy a 10.25-year bond, and I hold that for 6 months, and I just keep rolling that strategy. And so there's actually trading returns within that as a strategy as well. And given bond yields are so low and, it's not something we suggest investors should be doing. We're sort of more along the lines of most retail investors have got a bond ladder and that's enough. The people who are doing those 10-year bond, as I said, are doing that with leverage and they're doing with long shorts and trying to say, oh, we made, 0.1% here, but we leverage it up. So it turned into 1%. And we've done that every month, and we got this 12% return or whatever by using it as some sort of trading strategy.
Mm.
So, so when you see what the returns are in 10-year bonds, keep in mind that's often quite different to what you get on a real bond portfolio.
Okay.
And then that final point I had there was just that that's what traders are actually out there. You know, in terms of the real risks on bonds, is the traders doing those trades. Investors, you're actually getting more certainty because, as I spoke before, You've locked in your purchase price. You know what your exit price is, and you know exactly how many dollars of dividends you're going to get or distribution you're going to get over the time period.
Okay, sure.
I might flick on to the next one.
Yeah, we'll jump across to corporate bonds.
One more on just an inflation. So I've probably already spoken enough about inflation. It is worth noting though that two things. One is there's things called inflation linked bonds. And with all these government bonds, you can buy these on the ASX. They're all listed. You can just pick up the government bonds there under GSC. They all start with or GSI, and then they've got longer codes. But just bought normally through a broker. Some of these inflation-linked bonds, what they do is you get a bond, and it actually the payments increase and the bond's value increases by inflation every year. So let me put that a little bit better. So I buy a bond I bought it on issue at $100, and it might only be paying a 1% yield on that $100. But what will happen is the $100 the amount I'm going to get back at the end will increase by inflation every year.
Yep.
So that $100, you know, if we've got 2% inflation for 10 years, we'll end up being $130 or something like that with compounding. And I'll be getting a 1% return on the 130. So every year, my yield will go up, and every year my capital return will go up with whatever inflation is. So if you're really concerned about inflation, but you want to get bonds within your portfolio, inflation-linked bonds are great at the right price.
Yep.
It's just a question of how much inflation is priced into the bonds. And so this is not a trade where we're doing at the moment, but at the right time, you're a big fan of inflation-linked bonds for really giving stability to people, because it solves that problem we spoke about in terms of you're worried about inflation might run up to 3 or 4%. Well, if you own inflation-linked bonds, then that's not a problem, because that just means your bond value goes up by that 3 or 4% every year.
Just a quick one on that. We've got a question that's popped in from Craig. Thanks, Craig. What is the best inflation hedge? TIPS, which is the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, or gold? Yeah.
TIPS. So, TIPS are the US version.
Yep.
In the Australian one says inflation
linked bonds.
I'm sure if there's a short term acronym for it, but inflation linked bonds in the Australian
ones. ILB.
So the issue with gold is that it is a volatile investment as well. So whereas these bonds are locked in, you know what you're getting, and you know with an inflation linked bond, you know you're going to get inflation plus some sort of small return on it.
Yep.
And that's locked in. Whereas gold is, you might double your money, you might halve your money. You know, there's typically gold is a good hedge for inflation, but there's been periods where it hasn't been a good hedge at all for inflation.
Right.
So, so you just need to be quite careful. Sort of in the 80s when all the central banks were selling down, we had quite high inflation, but the gold price plummeted. And so, before that in the 70s, for a period in the 70s, it was this fantastic hedge on inflation. And then for the 80s, it was a terrible hedge for inflation. So, gold at the right point is a good investment. But I think it gets too much credit for being a good inflation
pure
hedge.
Currency hedge. Okay. Yeah, sure. Or inflation hedge.
And the last one, the duration. So the longer, if you buy a longer term bond, it is worth noting that you're going to be more impacted by price movements. So if you buy a 1 year bond, for example, or a 2 year bond, and interest rates went to 6%, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect you much. And even if it did affect you, if you got a 1 year bond, well, I know I'm getting $100 in a year's time anyway, so I'm just going to wait for that time if you want for it. If you buy the 10 or 20 year bonds, that will really make a big difference. Surge in inflation.
Okay.
Okay. So
just finally on that, before we jump across to corporate bonds. So obviously when we buy the GSBs on which are, through the ASX and broken up larger sovereign bond issue. What about buying at the initial $100? How does somebody do that? I had that question from somebody during the week, actually. Like, how do you pay face value on an issue? Because that seems like the domain of the institutionals that probably then resell it back down into the secondary market.
Yeah, but they don't always make a profit on it. And sometimes if you're buying it on day one, you're going to get pretty close to $100. Sometimes you might pick it up for $99, sometimes you might pay $101. But, especially on these longer-term bonds, it's not in the scheme of the whole bond over the life of its period, you're talking quite small amounts.
Okay. In terms of the
difference. But, I don't think... I'm actually not 100% sure whether they do when they put out new issues, whether you can buy them on the ASX. You might be able to buy them in the initial part on the ASX.
Right.
I must admit, I'm not sure.
Okay. That's fine.
Corporate bonds.
Let's jump across. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Uncertainty has never been higher.
Yeah.
It's a fair point.
So this is the issue, is corporate bonds. So coronavirus hits. Markets tank, corporate bonds all lock up. None of these things, not all of them, but any of the higher risk ones aren't trading. And even the lower risk ones, the yields sort of take this big jump to reflect that, hey, there's quite a quite a difficult time in for corporates coming up. Then central banks and governments sort of step in and basically suspend a bunch of rules. So the US central bank in particular was out buying higher grade corporate bonds. We have lots of countries, and Australia included, have sort of suspended or made it bankruptcies a lot harder during this period in mm-hmm. terms of you can't smaller businesses, you can't sort of you can't make them bankrupt if they're for within the corona period.
Yep.
So you've got this issue about saying, well, how long are these rules going to last for? And at some stage, like we've already had the UK came out, just last night, I think talking about their plan for pulling things out and stopping a lot of these payments, and basically just saying, well, you know, there's never a good time to stop, but eventually if you can't keep, governments can't keep putting money into businesses that no longer are going to operate. So you can't just prop them up in the hope.
Hmm.
Say if it's a tourism operator and you're saying, well, it could be years before that comes back. You can't have government sitting there just propping these things up forever. And so they're talking about saying, well, they're going to finish up in October, I think. And then he was basically saying, well, there's people, if I finished in November, then there'd be people saying that I should finish in December. And if I finish in December, it should be January, you know, whatever period it is. But at some stage, governments will need to say, okay, we're going back to normal rules. And that's the biggest danger for corporate bonds, is that there are companies that are insolvent. So Hertz is a good example. We saw Virgin locally.
Mm, yep.
So the issue has been that you've got this quite a high uncertainty about cash flows and can companies manage to get through the period. And on the flip side, because the central banks have been out buying corporate bond yields, they're actually quite relatively expensive, particularly in relation to the risk. So so you don't pick up particularly high yields, and you take a lot of risk on the corporate bonds might go broke.
Yep.
So I guess for me, I'm much more comfortable saying buy some lower yield government bonds, or buy some stocks where you've actually got upside. You're not getting much your yields are very low and everything, but you might actually get upside. But the problem in corporate bonds is you're getting hardly any upside at all, and you've got lots of downside. So at least in stocks, I do think they're too expensive at the moment. They're in a bubble, but you can make an argument that the returns are possibly there if central banks keep throwing money in, and the stocks will actually go up more, and some of the stocks will actually do better out of the coronavirus and stuff like that. So you make arguments for buying stocks within corporate bonds, but it's pretty hard for me to turn around and say, well, yes, I'm going to get for the next 5 years, I'm going to get a 4% return by buying some corporate bond, and there's a risk that this thing could go broke and I'll lose half my capital. And saying, well, for 4%, it's just not worth the low yields.
Yep.
And so that's this whole part about this uncertainty. The fixed versus floating is worth noting as well. So you can some corporate bonds are fixed, like I said, the government bonds ones were, but a lot of them are also floating. And typically in Australia, you'll see that's where the hybrids sort of sit. And the issue with floating is
just to peel that back. So a fixed rate might be it pays 5% per annum on the initial amount, say $100, where floating might be linked to the cash rate plus a certain amount or something like that.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
So the benefit, I guess, of floating at the moment is you don't really have much interest rate risk because we think we've hit the bottom, or we're pretty close. Maybe we'll go to negative interest rates and they might go lower, but but the problem with that, though, so that sounds sort of like a good thing in a way. Oh, there's only upside. So if interest rates rise, my interest will go up. But the issue is, because they're not going to go any lower as well, and they're already very low, is you're just not getting high returns on these things.
That's right. Yeah.
And so
yeah. So a typical hybrid might be 2.5-3% on top of the rate, which, if it was 2 or 3%, then you're looking at 6, which is a pretty good deal. Now it's more like 0.25 plus 2.
Yeah.
And all the credit risk.
And the hybrids are, Yeah, or even worse, because they're sitting right at the bottom of the capital stack, so to speak. So if a company goes broke, or goes into, let's take Virgin as an example, you know, shareholders are losing a lot. The next off the cap to lose is the most junior debt. So there's like there's various levels of debt in terms of seniority. So the senior debts are the last to lose their money, and the junior debts are the first to lose their money. And because the junior debt is the first to lose their money, they'll get a higher. They usually, when things are good, they get a higher interest rate return.
Yep.
The problem is that's where hybrids sit. So when things go wrong, they're the first people to be wiped out. And then eventually, once, you know, in terms of a bankruptcy, once the debt guys are wiped out, then the creditors start getting wiped out, and then finally, all the way up to the employees, sort of the last ones to lose money.
Yep. Oh, and the other thing, because the hybrids can convert into equity, can't they? Which is fantastic if equity is currently worth nothing.
Yeah, that's right. So there's some of them have got quite fancy dilution and conversion things, and I always, you know, I think whenever you're looking at these instruments and they're not simple, they've become something quite complicated. It's usually not because they've got your best interests at heart. It's usually not because they're sitting there going, you know, I really want to work out the best way I can, you know, I can make Tim benefit if everything goes wrong. It's usually the other way around, that they're going, well, if everything goes wrong, I want to make sure that
I'm protected,
and Tim takes the hit. Yeah. So the big issues are this whole government backing. Which companies are government backed? Which ones aren't? I mean, that's sort of this whole, you know, part of this moral hazard issue, and saying, well, is it right that you're bailing out? So in the US, you're bailing out some cruise ship operators and airlines, or should they be, you know, which one's going to be more like the Virgins, where they're allowed to go bust, or Hertz, where it's allowed to go bust? And so, a lot of these are just trading on speculation as to which ones are going to be supported and which ones won't. And that's, you know, there's money to be made there, but it's not really an investment. It's more of a guess as to who's going to get the benefit and who won't.
Yep.
The next one is how you buy corporate bonds.
Yep.
So there's a few things I just want to make sure that it's important to know when you're implementing. Is most people are going to be probably looking at exchange traded funds, because if you want to buy corporate bonds, you usually have to deal in quite large sizes if you're going to be in the over the counter market. You know, $100,000 tranches, or some even $500,000 tranches if you want to buy. So it's not sort of a matter of being able to say, oh yeah, let me, you know, I've got my $300,000, let me go and pick up, you know, half a dozen corporate bonds to put in my portfolio, because they'll be sort of saying no, you can have, you know, you can have one.
Yep.
So most people try to invest through exchange traded funds, and it's worth noting, though, there's a few big issues if you are going to invest in exchange traded funds. Is first, check what the actual underlying securities are. So for Australian exchange traded funds in particular, you can end up with a lot of exposure to some European banks, which you might not have been expecting.
Right.
The other thing is some of the corporate bond exchange traded funds basically have Aussie banks and Telstra. You know, so you think you're getting a diversified corporate bond portfolio, and really you've just got, you know, four different banks and Telstra. And so you know, knowing what you're actually buying in that underlying is important within those ETFs. And the other thing is, be prepared for the fact that these ETFs can have liquidity issues. So when when you've got a liquid instrument, you know, if we go back into sort of periods like we saw early on in the year where the markets start to lock up, then some of these ETFs can't trade, or they have to trade at prices that are so low that the market makers will make money on because they're not trading. They're basically saying, okay, whatever it is, it's worth $100. But there's a bid for $80 and an ask for $120. And so there's this huge spread. And so if you're trying to get out, you know, they're giving you the $80.
Yeah, because right.
The market maker's then saying, well, I don't know what I can sell this thing for. Yeah, I think it's worth $100, but I'm going to have to sell it at $80 because it's all, the liquidity is not there, and they're not going to make a loss sort of helping you to get out. So liquidity issues. And then the other thing is fund lockups if you're in unlisted or even if you're in some managed funds where what happened during the financial crisis was these things just went, thanks for your money, Tim. Unfortunately, you know, liquidity issues and all that type of stuff. The fund's locked up and we're going to start selling down the assets and we'll return the money over the next 2 years to you.
Yep.
So, yeah, so that, which all comes back to that whole, you know, you want these corporate bonds for your yield, but if things start to go wrong, then corporate bonds are a tough place to be.
Yep. Okay.
Now, I'll move on to stocks. So, the first thing on stocks I just wanted to highlight was this whole sector diversification part. So, I've used these. This is a Fidelity chart, which is just sort of showing the main sectors of the market versus each other. And so, what you're looking for is you're looking for diversification in this. So the ones that are highlighted is utilities and information technology. And you can see it's got a low correlation of 0.2, which basically means, you know, if one goes up, so if you had a correlation of one, then one of them goes up, the other one goes up by the same amount on the same week.
Yep.
Whereas at 0.2 means they both might go up by the same amount over a 3 or 4 year period, but one of them might go up for the first couple of years, and then the next one might go up for the next few years. And so you've got this diversification of all your eggs aren't sitting in one basket. So when you're putting your portfolios together, you want that whole mix of diversification so that you're not getting, say, for example, you know, you might think you're diversified by buying four different Aussie banks, but they're all moving together in prices. And they generally do.
Yep.
So you want to spread it out amongst sectors. The thing is, though, the sector correlations are not what they used to be. So this is like a longer-term look at sector correlations. But there's a whole bunch of other ways that we look at it as well. So you can sort of keep some of this in mind. But that sort of last slide has a lot of that details where we're saying, okay, well, you got to look at, for us, COVID and non-COVID stocks. So, you know, if you've got the ones, the travel stocks and the energy stocks and banks that are quite COVID reliant, whereas there's other stocks that are, you know, some of your healthcares and consumer staples that aren't really affected by COVID. So having that diversification is important.
Yep.
And those sectors aren't they're not the way it typically would work. So say in a typical cycle, you know, maybe or a typical smaller cycle, your REITs, your real estate investment trusts might actually be a source of stability for you. But at the moment they're not. And so whereas then you get into say the utility space and something like an electricity generator might be quite stable, but a gas pipeline might not be. And so there's issues with the same correlations that happened before aren't happening today. So you want to look at correlations, but you want to also keep this one in mind. We'll also look at a bunch of other ways. So interest rate sensitive versus insensitive stocks. So which are the stocks that really benefit as interest rates fall? Versus the ones that doesn't really make much of a difference to.
And so, Damien, is that a sector thing or a stock thing per se? Would be an example of a sector or a stock that would be.
So banks, utilities as well.
Yep.
Most utilities are, you know, interest rates go down, they tend to go up.
Yeah. Right.
And the insensitive ones are maybe you take some of your tech stocks or things that are not reliant. There's some more of your growth stocks.
Mm-hmm.
You got these cyclical, non-cyclical issues in terms of there's some companies that do really well when the economy does well and really badly when the economy does badly. So you could sort of they're what you'd usually call a cyclical stock.
Yep.
And so something like a media company might be in that bucket where when things are going well, lots more people spend on advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And then but when things start going badly, people pull back their advertising pretty quickly.
Yep. Okay.
Growth and value is another split. I probably won't go into that. That's more of a technical one for But we also look at business types, so manufacturers versus service companies versus what we call landlords, which is not always just – you can get people that are basically sitting on intellectual property as well and not really doing anything. And so the way these businesses react is different. So and I guess what I mean by that is you might look at two companies in the energy sector, and one of them might be a one of them might be a refiner, so takes in crude oil, refines it into various types of fuel, and takes a margin.
Yep.
And there that might be quite stable over the period, whereas somebody who's a service company to oil rigs out there drilling new oil rigs can be very volatile, and you know, we've got a very, very different business model. So the sector chart we showed before can hide some really big differences between how companies within the same sector will react when things happen.
Yeah,
and
right.
And then finally the country side. So
yep. All right, very good. And I'll just quickly throw out to anyone listening in, head over to nicholaswealth.com/webinar for any final questions. I've got a couple here. So just on that, and thanks for that, I think just rolling back into that sort of COVID, non-COVID piece, in your experience, obviously now we've had, 3-4 months, of being able to watch what's been happening. Has there been any surprise sectors or companies, I guess? Obviously, you did a lot of work in February, and there was a lot of work done in the portfolio to make it COVID resilient and try and find some upside and also avoid the losers. Was there sort of any, I guess, you know, upside surprises in over the last sort of few months that where companies had sort of, I don't know, been net beneficiaries that were, you know, immediately obvious, perhaps?
Probably the one that always jumps to mind on that front was Smucker, JM Smucker, which is one of the biggest pet food companies in the US.
Yep.
Where we had it and we thought, oh yeah, that's pet food should be relatively stable, I guess, during the downturn. And it actually a lot more people have started buying
high end dog food.
High end dog food and or pets.
Or pets, yeah.
Yeah. Now they're at home the number of pets sort of increased quite dramatically, and so some areas like that. I think there's certainly the online trading stuff was one. We didn't have any in our portfolio, but that's one where I guess it's an interesting question about saying, well, when sport stops, people get bored, and so then they look for other ways to lose money on gambling, and so the day trading becomes attractive, I suppose.
Yep.
So I think there's lots of those unexpected versions that popped out, which I think post it, you can sort of sit back and go, well, yeah, I can see why that happened. But I guess there's certainly a number of things we look at in terms of the things we beat ourselves up for are the ones where we go, yes, that there was a reason why we should have seen that coming and jumped into that.
Mm.
Whereas as opposed to the ones going, well, I can understand why it happened, but being able to predict it beforehand, you sort of can't beat yourself up too much for not picking the fact that sport would be cancelled, and therefore people would then open up online trading accounts in record numbers. And
it's an enormously difficult task given the fact that there's no immediate comparison sort of period, is it? You know, just sort of put on the list for the next pandemic and
that's right.
And
the issue at the moment is our portfolio has still been outperforming, during the period, and we've sort of stuck with a lot of those names, but they're getting expensive, and we've been gradually tipping them out as they get expensive and trying to roll into ones that are still we're not ready to go back to the real losers from the pandemic, say the cruise liners and airlines and stuff like that. Mm. So we're not ready for those yet.
Sure.
But finding stocks in that aren't overpriced and is more and more difficult, because I think obviously there's a lot of people who've been talking about this whole rise in the stock market as being a bubble, and I think certainly in the professional markets it's very much looked upon that way. And so what it means is there's some pretty crowded trades in people all trying to jump into that same sort of safety trades. So the ones we could jump on in January and February, are now priced at 20%, 30%, 40% more relative to other stocks than what they were before. So we spent a lot of time on relativity, I suppose, as we're doing our portfolio, just saying, well, when everything's expensive and we've got a certain amount of stocks we're going to hold in our portfolio, then we just need to find the ones that are the least expensive for the quality that you're getting.
Mm, okay. All right. Fantastic. Very good. Any final notes? We're sort of running just on time now, so happy to wind it up there if you like, Damien.
Yep. Sounds good.
All right. I'm gonna... Fantastic. Well, look, yeah, thanks to everybody who popped in some questions there. And also, of course, you can drop in any further notes or questions in the YouTube chat channel as well. Thanks very much to you, Damien, for a great show. And I think it's helped to answer certainly a lot of questions that I've had from potential and even current clients over the last few months in trying to really get your head around exactly where some income sources can be and what the pressure is there. So thanks for that. Thanks to everyone else for tuning in, and we hope you enjoyed today's show. So if you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date with news from us. Follow us on all our social media channels, or your favorite ones for that matter. We always appreciate guest or topic suggestions, so if you've got one, please drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video, and we'll approach that person or people and see if we can get them on the show. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, feel free to let them know about it, share it with a friend, and help our show grow. So on that note, thanks very much for tuning in, and we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.